Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, January 26th. I'm Ray Graff. It's climate change today. We discuss the topic with Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. Dan has over 25 years of experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies. So if you have a climate change question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can reach out via email, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLury and your climate change calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here to answer your climate change questions, we have expert Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. Dan DeLury has over 25 years of experience, including as an executive with utilities and clean energy companies, and has presented at congressional hearings, federal and state agency hearings, and White House special events. He was twice elected to participate in the Conference on World Affairs of the University of Colorado, where he joined 99 other international experts. He's considered to be a pioneer in developing content policy and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. Hey, you got a question about climate change or emerging technologies? Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, that number is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLury, welcome to the show.
Hello, Ray. Happy to be with you this afternoon.
Very nice to have you here. And our mutual friend, it's surprising, someone who's into emerging technologies is good friends with an old fossil fuel internal combustion Gordon Fricke. How about that, huh?
Well, I keep telling Gordon that he has to get ready for electric vehicles because they'll be here before he knows it.
Now, you know, according to the CV that I looked at before the show, you were a utility executive. And then during the Clinton administration, you began sort of working with the White House, the State Department, Congress to develop climate change policy for utilities. Explain what you did back then.
Well, I was doing that as a utility executive. I was running the Washington office for a company which was then called New England Electric, and they were the parent company of, among others, Massachusetts Electric, which some of your audience will remember. And so we were seen as a fairly progressive and green utility. We had begun to look at projects where we could reduce emissions someplace else and use them as offsets against our emissions. We were among the first, or I guess maybe we were the first, to endorse a carbon tax. And so we viewed climate change and the greenhouse effect and the emissions and all of that as something that needed to be tackled right away. So not all utilities viewed the situation that way, and so it gave me and my company an opportunity to work with the Obama administration to craft some policy, both on the Hill, but also executive orders and so on.
Could you give an example of some of those policies?
Well, I mean, on the Hill, this was coming on the heels of the Clean Air Act and the institution of what's known as cap and trade. That was not about climate change, but it set in place a structure for people to begin talking more specifically about how to control carbon emissions. Now, that didn't lead to cap and trade at the federal level, but the work that was done over those years helped put in place regional and state cap and trade programs. But there were other things like new energy efficiency standards, new building codes, which of course leads to how you mitigate climate change and reduce emissions. So some of it is the same thing that you would do without talking about climate change. But when you talk about climate change, those are the things you have to do.
We're joined today by Dan DeLury, who's a Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School, and very happy to have you here. Before we get into some of the technologies that may lead the way in coming decades, just to kick things off, give us a basic, easy to understand, pray see of the science behind climate change.
Sure, thanks. I'd love to do that. And also, I can't overemphasize the importance of people understanding the basics of the science, because the science is so different than so many other things that unless you understand it, you really won't appreciate the situation that we're in. And so let me contrast it with acid rain to start off. We all remember acid rain, particularly in this region. And acid rain happened when tall smokestacks in the Midwest emitted all sorts of pollutants, among them sulfur dioxide. The winds brought it over to our region. And at that point, it precipitated out in the form of sulfuric acid and fell on our cars and fell on our forests and so on. Now, in the case of carbon dioxide, when it goes into the atmosphere, it stays there for hundreds of years before it falls out. And so what you've had ever since industrial times in the 1800s is a constant buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You've had from a concentration of 280 parts per million back then to 412 parts per million now. Now, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and that means when it's in the atmosphere, it acts as a heat-trapping gas. Not all of the heat that is sent to the Earth by the sun is allowed to go back out. So that's the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect leads to global warming. It leads to warming of the air, the water, and the land on Earth. Okay? When you have global warming, then you have climate change. It changes seasons, it changes the freeze-thaw cycle, it changes rainfall patterns, it changes the intensity of storms, it changes the circulation currents in the ocean, and so on. So it's really about the concentrations, and if the CO2 does not fall out in our lifetime, in fact, let me say this, because this is something that I read recently, and it gets back to 2020 being probably the warmest year that we've ever had. But it also may be the coolest year that any of us alive today may ever experience for the rest of our lives.
Then are you suggesting, Dan DeLurie, that it is already past that not mythical, but certainly hypothetical red line, where at that point it's a point of no return? Have we passed that point?
No, we've not passed that point. I don't want to be Mr. Doom and Gloom here, but people do have to understand what the situation is. I mean, I go back to talking about the Obama administration. The first hearings on climate change were held on top of Capitol Hill in 1988. And if we had begun to tackle it then, that's 30 years of action that could have reduced emissions. And during that time, emissions have continued to pile up. But in terms of the red line, no, because this is a sliding scale. I mean, so much change is baked in to climate change already that it's not like things are not going to change. It's a question of how fast they change and how they change. So we need to tackle climate change in terms of reducing CO2 emissions. But there's also the other side of the coin. We also have to start focusing on adaptation, because there is a lot of change coming, which we can't do anything about.
And that's a whole show and a series of shows in itself, Dan DeLurie.
There is a lot to talk about here. I think the area of climate change is more complex than people think. There's the science of it. There's what to do about it, how to adapt to it, and so on.
You know, we hear about decarbonizing, and right. I wonder if you can explain how a society, how a company, or even an individual might do that. Now, bear in mind, we have about 2 minutes until the break, and then at that point, okay, we'll take calls. By the way, the number is 800-348-2551 if you'd like to talk to Dan DeLurie today. Anyway, this whole business about decarbonizing, how can we do it?
Well, decarbonization is a word which simply means using less or no carbon to run our economy and society. I mean, the best example probably is using solar and wind energy. That's producing electricity without burning any carbon-based fuel. And so you suddenly have an emissions-free form of electricity. And that is why you hear a lot about electrification these days. Because if you have a car or anything else, your home, for example, that runs on electricity, as the grid gets cleaner from solar and wind, then everything that you have that uses electricity will get cleaner as well. It's kind of the gift that keeps on giving from a climate standpoint.
No, I meant carbon sequestration, but I think that's another story. Let's talk in a moment.
Happy to talk about that, but yeah.
Let's take a quick break, and then I want to talk about wind energy and maybe solar. Governor Cuomo recently announced a new plan for offshore wind, and let's talk about the developments there and the efficiencies involved. Dan DeLurie's our guest. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk climate change with Dan DeLurie of Vermont Law School. Well, Dan, I mean, give me an over-under here. How many years before you can get Gordon into an electric car?
I'm not sure he will have a choice.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, there are different estimates for the fleet turning electric, but that seems to be inevitable. And it's just a question of when.
And now let's just tackle this business about wind energy and the advances there, the efficiency improvements in solar, et cetera. We have a growing list of callers on the line, and we have a stack of emails here, and I want to get to those. But very quickly, wind energy, there has been some controversy about it. Early on, they said, well, you're not going to generate enough juice from that. Now there are some fishery industries that are perhaps a little less than enthused in some areas. Tell me the good and the bad about wind energy.
Well, you've opened up a lot of different aspects of it just in what you said.
Yep.
But offshore wind energy, it's kind of basic in that the wind blows harder and steadier offshore in most parts of the world. And so you've got a chance to harness that kind of energy. One of the complaints about onshore wind energy is that it can often be intermittent, and how much can you rely on it? And that's why utilities and power grids have tried to put together portfolios of things so that if one type of resource is not available, then another type is. The other thing about offshore wind is it's a little bit easier to lay a transmission line. A lot of people want all transmission lines to be put underground, all existing transmission lines, because of storm damage and things like that. But that is prohibitively costly, and that just is not going to happen. And so those are a couple advantages to wind energy. Now, again, you've got a new structure in the water, and you know, some people will argue aesthetics. Some people will argue other impacts. But one of the things that we're going to have to kind of come to grips with, probably all of your audience has heard of the term NIMBYism. And one of the things which we have to look at is maybe being a little bit more tolerant of solar panels being placed in a solar farm or wind turbines being placed offshore. I mean, if we're really going to decarbonize, we've got to come to grips with some of that.
Let's talk quickly, and then we'll get to the phones, about solar. Where do we stand? What is the state of the art in efficiency for solar power today?
You know, I don't know that number, Ray. I know it's continued to increase, and one of the markers for that is that solar farms have been able to compete at extremely low levels of electricity production. A lot of power procurement around the country is done through auctions or bids, And a big breakthrough has been solar-generated electricity beating natural gas. The price of natural gas dropped a lot when fracking came on the scene. And that's why natural gas took up a lot of the power production as coal was backed off. If not for fracking, then you probably would have had solar and wind advance even quicker than it has.
Now, with regard to solar panels, and I promise, Dave in Woodstock, you'll be first. We'll go to the phones in one moment, 800-348-2551. With regard to solar panels, am I wrong in that most of the, not heavy metals, but what's that, rare earths that you need to make these are in China? Isn't that a potential problem long term?
That's hard for me to comment on. It is true that some of the elements of solar panels are most available offshore. China is one of the countries. There are also some African countries as well. But I can't really comment on that other than to say that you're correct. There is an issue there.
Dan DeLurie is our guest, and now we have to go to the phones, 800-348-2551, and we start with Dave in Woodstock. Dave.
Hello, Ray and Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
You're on.
Yes. What is the timeline for the tilting point, or is that what it's called, the tipping point of the frozen methane?
A tipping
at the bottom of the sea and in the permafrost.
Oh, I see.
At the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, sorry. Let me just clarify for everyone what you're, I think, asking, and that is that
please.
That permafrost, I think we all have heard of it, and that is what most of the land area is in some of the Arctic areas. And permafrost is, as the name connotes, it's always frozen. And as it thaws out, you've got all of that plant matter in that land that then releases methane. Methane is another greenhouse gas. The good news is that it falls out of the atmosphere quicker than CO2, but the bad news is it's 25 times as potent while it's there. But as to your question, I don't know exactly what the tipping point is, and it's really hard in talking about climate to talk about one particular point. And that's why you have climate scientists talking about scenarios. And it really depends on a whole bunch of aspects and characteristics and components of what's done to try and decarbonize land preservation. But I want to add to your question that the Arctic is one of the fastest warming areas on the globe. It's I don't know what the percentage is. I've seen it, but I don't recall it. But the Arctic region, I know Alaska, I think, went up 7 more degrees on average than the rest of the U.S. over the past decade. So there is going to be a tipping point, but I would encourage you to think of it more as a sliding scale based on what we do and what happens.
Well, thanks for the call. We're joined today by Dan DeLurie, a senior fellow for energy and climate at Vermont Law School. 800-348-2551, the number. John is in Albany. John, you're on.
Hi, I was just wondering if Dan knows sort of what the state of carbon sequestration is and whether that has a real future to make an impact on carbon.
The second part of your question, yes, it does, and it's part of pretty much everyone's plan. To the first part, as to the state of it, that's still evolving. And let me address what sequestration is. It involves securing carbon so that it isn't emitted to the atmosphere, or it could also be removing carbon from the atmosphere. And the example of the latter is trees and plants, which take in carbon dioxide. And so this is why forest preservation, and you see this a lot in the context of the fires in the Amazon and how much vegetation that would otherwise absorb CO2 is being destroyed. And so The as you can guess, one of the challenges with this is trying to make sure that the mechanisms are in place to ensure that what is sequestered remains sequestered. And that requires more than just simple agreements. There's also, as I mentioned earlier at the start of the hour, this idea of offsets. And that is that it may be cheaper to preserve part of the rainforest in Brazil than to do something here in the U.S. Even though the thing here in the U.S. may be the right thing to do, in order to get to where we need to be, we need to do the fastest and most economical thing that we can. So I'm not sure that answers your question. There's also work being done on sequestration in cement, for example, and injecting CO2 into underground caverns. But that's not something that people talk about as much as trying to reduce the CO2 in the first place.
John, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Climate Change Today with Dan DeLury, Vermont Law School. By the way, are you happier working at a law school or back in industry?
Well, that's a tough question. Uh-huh. I mean, my studies as an undergrad focused on science, and then my graduate work focused on public policy. And the public policy part of things really drew me into that area, using my science basis to understand it better and be able to explain it better to people. So I like them both. By being with Vermont Law School, and I'm not sure people know what Vermont Law School is. It's an independent law school that was started back in the 1970s. And it's consistently, year in and year out, ranked as one of the number one schools for environmental law across the U.S.
Mm.
Well, and thanks for letting me get that plug in.
And, you know, diplomatically answered. Well done, sir. Dan DeLury is our guest. This email is so simple and yet so eloquent. This is from Sarah in Pelham, wondering, what is the best single thing I can do to help prevent climate change?
Well, my answer may surprise you, but it shouldn't be one single thing. But I would say you need to talk to all of your friends and associates about it. There's too little talk about climate change and what it means and what we have to do. And you can, you know, talk about in terms of what kind of things you should do around your house to make it more efficient. Buildings as a sector emit a tremendous amount of emissions. I've got the number somewhere as to what that is. I think it's like 26% of total emissions. So anything you can do in your home is great. But I think back to what I said about talking to each other, there's really a legacy issue going on here. I mean, we have in the past 100 to 150 years taken some actions and benefited from them that are now poised to make the future quite a bit different for those who come after us. So I really think that the more we talk about it, it will reinforce each of us in terms of what we do, whether it be taking actions or whether it be being a climate voter and having climate as one of the primary issues upon which we cast our ballot.
We're joined today by Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. The number is 800-348-2551. One more email here, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This one's from Jeff and Troy. Jeff says, methane is not villainous. I'm totally on board with the need to stop extracting fossil fuels, but I think it is a serious mistake to cast methane as a bad thing. It's a normal part of the biosphere, and it's a pretty simple molecule to synthesize using renewable energy. A methane-powered infrastructure would be far simpler than hydrogen, and all the infrastructure already in place for home heating and cooking does not need to become stranded assets. That's a huge system that does not need to be replaced at gargantuan cost. The money would be better spent on expanding renewable energy itself, and that is from Jeff in Troy.
Wow, there's a lot in that one. I think Jeff is equating methane with natural gas and the use of natural gas as a fuel, not only in power plants to produce electricity, but also in homes. But the fact is, methane is methane. And as I said earlier, it's quite a potent greenhouse gas. And so, in fact, some of the latest research has shown that perhaps we're having more methane emissions than we really thought. So, I mean, we're talking about methane emissions from the flaring of oil and gas, but we're also talking about them from livestock. 2% of total emissions are from cows and other ruminants. And just to, there's a big confusion on this. It's belching. It's not coming out the other end.
Well, all right. It's a fine point, but all right. Fair enough.
It's contrary to what people think. But one of the areas that work is being done is on trying to improve the diet and the feedstock for livestock so that less methane is produced.
Oh, interesting.
But I want to touch upon one other thing, and that is natural gas use in the home. Natural gas has 50% of the carbon that oil and coal do, but that's still a lot of carbon. And so methane and natural gas, people have talked about them as a bridge to the future over the past 20 years, but they're still a fossil fuel. And in fact, some cities around the country have begun to put in place bans for new natural gas hookups in homes because of that.
We're joined today by expert Dan DeLore, a senior fellow for energy and climate at Vermont Law School. The number is 800-348-2551. Where do you stand on nuclear power?
Is that a question to me?
That's, well, yeah.
Yes, I'm pro-nuclear. Now, you know, there you have to divide the line between existing nuclear and future nuclear. And I do that because future nuclear hasn't developed as well as it should have, and I think we can probably all guess what the reasons are. But existing nuclear power plants are emissions-free electricity, and I think that too often they're not seen that way and not seen in the climate context. So I think preservation of our existing nuclear fleet, not only here but around the world, is when it comes down to the fight for climate change mitigation, I think, we shouldn't look askance at nuclear.
In the late 70s, we were at a point where the road went two different directions, and had we taken that other direction and nuclear power became more widespread throughout this country, do you think we're having a different discussion about climate change today?
Well, I mean, I know why that fork in the road existed and why the road was taken. So if we had more existing nuclear plants, then obviously we'd have more emissions-free electricity. But I'm not sure that's a fair way to look at it. I don't think that could have happened any other way based on the fact that climate was not the context in which decisions were made. And as I said, I think, nuclear going forward, it just isn't ready. We've talked about these modular nuclear plants, but not enough research has gone into them, and there's very little in the way of demonstration and deployment.
We better get back to the phones here and grab one more at least before our next break. Let's go to Hannah in Western Massachusetts. Hannah, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question for you is about waste obsolescence and infrastructure associated with batteries and other renewable energy solutions, and especially as it pertains to externalized costs onto ecosystems and environmental justice communities, people in environments that have to deal with extraction or disposal. And then I'm also wondering, are people thinking about this, and are people being represented as the exploration for holding or harvesting energy continues?
Yeah, thanks, Hannah. I'm not sure I can get into the specifics of the composition of the batteries. I mean, most batteries are still lithium-ion ion batteries. And as you know, and as was noted earlier when Ray talked about China, batteries are composed of some things that are not so nice when it comes to thinking of their afterlife. And so battery recycling, that's something that there's work being done on, but I can't really go too deep on that with you.
Go ahead.
Dan. No, that's fine, Ray.
All right, let's take a quick break. And Hannah, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to a few of those coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Dan DeLore, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law School. The number is 800-348-2551. Couple of quick emails here, Dan, and then we'll hit the home stretch with the calls. This one's from Mark. We keep hearing from President Biden and others who agree with him that the switch from fossil fuels to clean energy will create thousands of jobs. Can you please tell us what kind of jobs these will be, and how can regular everyday folks start to get some of these jobs?
Well, that's a very good question. The leading job creator by sector over the past 10 years has actually been in the clean energy sector. And a lot of that has...
I think we... Did we lose him? He looks like he's still connected. Our number here is 800-348-2551. We apparently have lost our guest, although I'm seeing him on the computer here. Tell you what, Zach, let's play a module, and we'll see if we can get our guest back on the line, if that's entirely possible. It is Vox Pop. We're joined today by Dan DeLore from Vermont Law School, who is now officially gone from our line, but we'll get him back. Don't worry. Everything will be fine. You know, he's probably using a wind turbine phone, and the wind died. So I'm sure we'll get him right back. We'll be right back. Oh, that's nice. Okay, I think we have our guest back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and Dan DeLore. That was exciting. Welcome back. You were saying, sir.
Yeah, well, I'm back, and I apologize. I have no idea what caused that.
That's all right, man. No sweat.
So what was I saying, Ray?
I don't know, but let's go to the next call or the next email. This is from...
Sorry about that.
What happens, you know, those technical things happen, and I see a red mist, and then I forget what I'm doing. So this is from Carrie. Carrie says, chemical engineer. There is a lot of exciting news about integrating new green technologies into the grid. My question is, how much of this technology, grid-scale energy storage, fuel cells, wind turbines, et cetera, will be developed and manufactured in the United States?
Wow, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And I now remember what the last question was. It was about jobs in the clean energy sector.
Oh, yes.
And mainly by solar installation, that is panels on buildings and roofs. Also, in terms of energy efficiency, it's been the fastest growing sector in the U.S. It's had a downturn because of the pandemic, but that's the one that will likely bounce back, including through new Biden and congressional policy.
Okay.
So in terms of green technology and who gets to do it, we've been losing that battle over the past 20 years. And again, I think that goes back to the lack of federal clean energy and climate policy. So you've had China being the primary country that's leaped forward to take that on.
Isn't China still one of the major polluters of carbon?
China is number one.
Yeah.
It jumped by us. They're doing some good things, but China is still the number one because of the growth that it's had. The U.S. is still the number one contributor in terms of total accumulation, but the U.S. is second now in terms of emissions.
Anyway, go on. I digress. Go ahead.
But, That's okay. But there is a lot going on here in the U.S., particularly with industries like grid modernization and using smart technologies in the electricity sector and also in homes and buildings and so on. So not everything has fled overseas, and we've got a lot left to do. And you've heard President Biden already talk about Buy American. And so I think you're going to see things snap back a little bit in terms of what happens here.
All right, to the phones we go. And I must say, we have a full bank of calls here. We'll do as well as we can to get through as many as we can. This is Jim in Elizaville. Jim, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just got a sort of a silly little question. I had to buy gas the other day to take a little trip into town. Round trip from my house to Red Hook is 10 miles. So it's 20 miles both ways. My car gets 20 miles to a gallon. Now, a gallon of gas the other day in Dutchess County cost $2.49. So it cost me $2.49 to go from my house to Red Hook and back, so 20 miles. How do you determine that those kind of figures with electric cars? How much electricity does, say, the average electric car need to go 20 miles, and what does that cost?
I love that.
I don't know when you take it down to 20 miles, but there are charts that show you the carbon footprint of an electric vehicle versus a gasoline-powered vehicle. And Ray, I don't know if you're going to give out any contact information for me, but
many
of the things we've talked about, I'm happy to chat with people offline afterwards.
Well, what's your email address, sir?
The email is ddelury, D-E-L. U-R-E-Y, at vermontlaw.edu.
Okay, and we'll make sure we have that link on our page.
I have one little extra thing I want to ask you.
Sure.
Can you tell me how many years the United States government has been subsidizing the oil industry in the United States? I think it's around 100 years. Am I correct?
It could be. I mean, it's been a long time, whether it's 100 or not, but that could be. And still doing it today, unfortunately.
Right. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Elliot in Lenox, Massachusetts. Elliot, you're up.
Yeah, I have a question about electricity. Everyone thinks of it as a green form of energy, but in fact, it takes energy to create electricity. And my question is, what percentage of the final output of electricity should be deducted because of how much it costs to generate that electricity?
When you pose that as a cost question, I'm a little bit less clear. I mean, you're correct that the most of the electricity generated in the U.S. is still done so from fossil fuels. Coal's been backed out, but it's been mainly substituted by natural gas. You've had renewable energy. I mean, last year, this is an important data point. Last year, all of the new electricity capacity in the U.S. came from renewables. But the cost of whatever the fuel is that goes into producing electricity is something that is rolled into the price that people pay for electricity. And I'm sorry if I'm not completely understanding your question.
Go ahead, Elliot.
Yeah, well, the question is very simple. The question is, for a unit output of electricity, how much does it cost to generate that? What percentage of the total output has to be deducted because that's the cost of generating electricity? Is it 80%? Is it 60%?
If you're putting it in terms of what you pay per unit on your bill, which includes transmission and local delivery, but also the generation of that electricity. It varies around
I'm
the country.
I'm strictly talking about generation.
Okay.
I'm strictly talking about generation.
Right. So generation, I'm gonna hazard a guess that on average it would be maybe 20 to 30% of your bill.
Okay, Elliot, thanks a lot for the call. We're joined today by Dan DeLory of Vermont Law School, and we talk climate and technology, and we go to Regina in Cahoes.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Yes. Hi. Thank you very much for this important session. My question is, what if we changed the suburban norm of neatly mowed lawns to having homeowners and renters create areas that are habitats for the birds and the bees, as well as space for individual state-of-the-art home gardens that include medicinal herbs? And what if we also included communal land for social gardens that could bring people together to socialize as friends and neighbors while watching the corn grow and the sheep graze?
Well, a couple of things. I think, first of all, back to the idea that vegetation actually helps in terms of taking carbon out of the air. So the more you devoted land area to vegetation, then better off. The other thing, it gets back to mowing those lawns. And one of the culprits, when you put them all together in terms of pollution, not just carbon, but other types of pollution, are the small engines that power lawnmowers and other pieces of equipment that we have. And so here's where I would put in a plug for electric lawnmowers, which have made tremendous advances. And again, as the grid gets cleaner with more wind and solar, your lawnmower will get cleaner just by sitting there.
Well, Regina, that was a very interesting call. Thank you very much. Let's go to Sal in Cambridge. Sal, you're on.
Sal, I'm probably David. And anyways, and Ray, I have to confess that I called once before on this topic with the science program, but this is my windmill.
All right, fair enough.
And so, anyway, so part of my life mission is to make Gordon Fricke fall in love with electric cars. I design them; it's my job. California in the year 2035 is going to be outlawing internal combustion engine powered cars, which is ducky. But my question is, in order to move this along for you guys, there's a lot of callers, is what are we going to feed all of the 1934 automobiles along with the cars that are already amongst us that have internal combustion engines? Now, there are two answers for this, dead dinosaurs being the wrong one.
Okay.
I've got a 1947 Alco locomotive that runs through the village of Cambridge here. It'll run on algae with no modifications whatsoever. If the idea is to move the needle, might this be a good idea?
All right, Dan, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, looking at biofuels, as they're called collectively, is a good idea. I don't think anyone is talking about, you know, bringing them to the mass market. But also I want to point out that no one is talking about taking older cars off the road as the electricity, as the electric vehicle revolution comes upon us. I mean, there may be certain things like carbon taxes or whatever that, you know, make running them be a little bit more expensive, but no one is saying that you can't run a gasoline-powered vehicle as we get electric vehicles.
All right, to Dan or Dave or Sal or whatever your name actually is, thank you for the call. Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Hello. Good to hear from you both, gentlemen.
Hi.
And my call is really just a perfect follow-up to both of the last ones. Regina was talking about kind of old-world ways of preventing the carbon buildup. So I was going to say, am I guilty with my backyard fire pit? Because I hardly use any other electricity, no computer, no Bitcoin, none of that.
Uh-huh.
That's just my first question.
Okay. Dan?
Okay. Wood contains carbon. I mean, all living things contain carbon. And when you think about it, the oil and coal and natural gas comes from, you know, original organic matter. So when you burn coal, when you burn wood, you are releasing carbon. So the question comes down to, you know, how Puritan do you want to be about these things? And wood, all the wood burning taken together is not a major contributing factor in terms of total emissions. And I think, you know, we have to be real about this and using a fire pit or using, you know, wood for certain purposes. It may release carbon, but it may have other benefits that I don't want to say shouldn't take advantage of.
All right, Joan, very quickly, your second question.
Sure. I like technology, but I do not trust computers. I would like an electric vehicle, but I will not allow that many minor computers controlling my driving. I love the last caller you had. Can't we retrofit some of our better operational vehicles?
Well, this is a question for Gordon, Ray, because I think most people would be surprised how much their existing vehicle is run by computers.
Oh, yeah.
And Gordon could probably talk at length about how the first thing he has to do when a vehicle comes in is plug it into his computer and find out what's wrong with it. But again, I mean, I'm not saying that existing vehicles, you want to make sure that you're doing all of the things to make them run better, because the fewer miles per gallon, that's your individual little contribution to reducing emissions.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. Now, we only have about 1 minute here, Dan. So how do people get in touch with you if they would like to ask you a question?
Well, again, my email address is ddelury, that's ddelury, at vermontlaw.edu.
I mean,
and also, for people who, I mean, you can find me on the, my first name is Dan, last name DeLure, and you can find me on the internet and on LinkedIn and various other places.
In the last 30 seconds we have, are you optimistic for the future?
Well, I have children and grandchildren, so I have no choice but to be optimistic. But optimism alone is not going to carry the day. And so, you know, my main objective is to try and help people understand that, you know, the situation is not that great. I'll even say it's not that good, and we don't have any more time to waste. We've really used up all of the easy time when we could have been doing things, and at this point, there's a lot of CO2 and temperature and sea level rise already baked in. There's nothing we can do about it. And the question is how to limit what's yet to come.
Well, sir, this was an enjoyable and informative hour, and I hope you do come back soon. Maybe you come back with Gordon Fricke and you guys can fight it out. What do you think?
Well, yeah, perhaps. I guess that's a question for Gordon.
All right, man.
I would love to. And I'd love to come back. There's a lot to talk about in this area. Right?
Well, let's do it then. Thank you, Dan DeLury, for being here. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, Careers in Transition, LLC.com. And Bergeron Electrical Services, for over 30 years, providing the Pioneer Valley and Western Massachusetts with all electrical services, interior and exterior lighting, generator installation, and more. BergeronElectrical.net. Once again, thanks to Dan DeLury of Vermont Law for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for calling. Thanks for emailing. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Carl Blackwood, Jackie Orchard, our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we switch gears and we talk plumbing with Alan Ayers. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for The Book Show.